Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show. Welcome to Money Matters, to the 225th edition of Money Matters, your economic forum. Be advised that discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Money Matters is about money. As money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another, controls the very way you live your life. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about... look in the mirror. You. Yes, markets rock and roll. You know, 2 weeks ago, I came on this show and I said, it seems like every time I come on this show, I have to talk about the market in turmoil. And here we are again. I can safely say that this has been the most historic market rout for the start of a new year in history. Dow is, you know, we had an all-time high about 18,300. That was a while ago, but the recent high, 17,700 after that 1,000-point wipeout. And 17,800, and then it corrected down to about 16,300. And then it started to rise again. And on the way up, it was mentioned a few times that the possibilities, of course, possibilities are endless. The market's going to go anywhere. But possibilities was a retouch to 16,300, even though it looked like it was headed back up to 18,000 again. And to nibble sparingly, because you can't tell. You don't know if the market's going to continue up or fall back down. And a retest to 16,300 was definitely in the cards. Obviously, we fell to 16,300 and continued to fall. The second major resistance point, in my opinion and in the opinion of some, such as Daily Reckoning and some other fine websites you could peruse, was the next stop. Possibility was 15,300. After that, I've seen figures at 15,000, 14,700, 14,500, 14,000, and on you go. So we had a scary start this week. Yesterday, I think, it started to go down. 2 days ago, it was down 500-something. And today, it was up 190-something. Today being Thursday, January 20th, 21st, 2016, year of our Lord. And by the way, on my website, I had the day wrong. I had today as show appears Thursday, January 20th. Well, that didn't make any sense. It was January 21st. That's today. So my apologies for that. And fell 500, ended up down 240, up 200 today, and now it's softening again. It's about 131 down, up at 15,898. So, obviously, my phone rings a lot when this happens, people wanting to know what is going on, where will the markets go. And, you know, no one knows. Not the Federal Reserve doesn't know, and I don't know, and nobody knows. We make our best guess, although it's not a guess. It's based on, I don't know, I base it on what I see. I base it sometimes on technical patterns. I base it on fear indexes, how many investors are fearful, how many puts and calls are bought, puts being people that are betting the market goes down, calls are bought by people betting the market goes up. You look at contrarian indicators. Contrarian indicators would be when everybody is all in and thinking the market will go up. That can be regarded as a contrarian indicator, which means the market could go down. And when everybody is totally pessimistic and does want nothing to do with stocks and is totally paranoid, that could be a contrarian statistic saying the market is ready to run. But there is no foolproof way to find out where this is going. So we have to practice the best we can do in good techniques on investing. And there's a variety of good techniques in a modern portfolio theory. One is diversification. Now, most people believe that diversification is a wide variety of stocks. I happen to believe a wide diversification is a wide variety of assets. Okay, not only stocks, but real estate and other things. You know, you could think of 10 or 20 assets. Your home could be an asset. The other thing would be, you know, some people believe in value investing, where you buy sectors that are beaten up, and other people buy the hottest stocks going, you know, like whatever the technology stocks people buy. But one of the things that is commonly thought to be a good technique, you know, markets generally, stocks generally move in concert. We call that market risk. In other words, you could have a variety of stocks, but if the market falls, they all fall. Or most can fall. And you've probably seen that, no matter how good some analysts are. If the market falls, the majority of stocks usually go with it. And so what can you do to prevent that? Let's say you hire an advisor, or let's say you yourself pick some stocks. And, you know, the day you pick 10 stocks, the odds of all 10 of them going up the next day are probably slim to none. And none slim left town, as they say. So you have to expect on any particular day that you buy a stock in a week, you know, some are probably going to be in the red and some hopefully will be in the black. But one of the things that you can do to practice good investing techniques is to develop a stop. And I have covered stops many, many times. Now, I'm not talking about entering a stop with your broker. Obviously, you can do that. But I'm talking about stop losses or mental stops. And a stop is just saying, I'm down so far, I don't want to take any more losses, I'll sell it. And, you know, some advisors practice stops. I would hope they all do. But some of the things that I've seen might lead me to believe otherwise. So I resurrected a article and also some information on a show I did multiple times. And it basically reads like this, and this is addressed stocks. Most investors took major losses on their stock portfolios in 2008 and 2009. We can comfortably say that. From my own experience, I saw many portfolios that were hammered to mercilessly hammered. And most would attribute these losses to plunging stock prices, obviously. Because of stock price plunge and the possibility of such, there are basic strategies that have mitigated some of those losses, yet few investors utilize these. One of the most important aspects of investing is not to lose money, or at least to minimize the losses. For if any investor is losing money, he obviously isn't making any. An analogy would be you can't go forwards if you're going backwards. It's an old saying in the markets, you cut your losers and let your winners run. A critical strategy in not losing money is having an exit point. An exit point is a certain percentage or a certain price, whatever you set at an exit point, that's where you are out. An exit point is a predetermined, hopefully, level or price that you would sell. The common mindset that prevents investors from limiting losses. And indeed, some advisors that I know, prevents them from limiting losses. They don't have a predetermined sell point. The common mistake is this. Let's assume the market starts to fall and an investor is looking at a 5% loss in his portfolio. The investor or his advisor handling the portfolio thinks or says, we're only down 5%, that's not enough to worry about. If the portfolio continues to drop 10%, the same excuse is used to hold. Now the portfolio in a down market drops 15%, then 20%, then 25%. The same excuse by the advisor or the investor is, it's not down far enough, so don't sell. If the market continues its descent, somewhere along the drop, usually between 25 or 30%, my opinion, the investor and or the advisor suddenly switches his mindset from you're not down far enough to you're down too far, you can't sell here. So you start out watching a declining portfolio saying you're not down far enough, 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 and then one day you wake up, it's down again, and you say, well, I'm down too far, I can't sell. What happened here is the change in thought process from I'm not down far enough to I'm down too far never had a middle ground. It never allowed for a sell strategy. In essence, there was never an exit point, a point where the investor says I'm down 24, 25% or whatever the number is and I'm out. I will say this. Investors are lucky the market stopped where it did during 2008 and 2009. We are lucky that the Federal Reserve came in there and started to initiate quantitative easing and open market operations, which basically means they start handing out money. For if they hadn't, the mindset of you're down too far now to sell would have convinced investors and probably most advisors to continue to ride the markets down. Because if you're down too far at 30%, when it's 40%, they're going to say, you're down even farther. So you're down too far, you don't want to sell. Stay in for the long haul. Not having an exit point really means the investor's never had a chance. Unlike leaving a casino after you've lost a certain amount, in stocks, most investors don't practice the same self-control they would be sitting in a slot machine. When you sit at a slot machine, you start gambling, you lose $200, and you say, that's it. I'm out. When you're down 10, you probably say, I'm not down far enough. Down $30, I'm not down far enough. But when you're down 200 or whatever your number is, you say, I've lost enough, I'm gone. You don't go say, well, I'm down too far now, I'll just go to the ATM and keep withdrawing money till I'm broke. You don't do that at a slot machine. However, it'd be probably less costly to do it at a slot machine than do it in your stock account. Not having an exit point is like never leaving a house that's on fire. You might not leave for a small fire in the garbage can or a small fire in your oven, but you sure would get the heck out if the kitchen went up in flames. That an investor or their advisor flops from you're not down far enough to you're down too far to sell now never allows for the cut the loss and run. There was never a fire escape or a point at which the investor, much like a losing slot machine, gets up and leaves. There's nothing wrong with that. Because no one can tell which way the market is going to go or how low it can go. It's not dumb to say I'm down, you know, 20%. I'm out, or whatever your number is. This common fault among investors and advisory firms leaves them open to massive losses and years of accumulated profits vanishing in one severe crash. Interestingly enough, there is a point some investors will sell their stocks. And it's a well-known point to market historians. When the average investor is down massively, 60, 70, 80, 90%, the investor or the significant other panics, calls up the advisor and says, "We've got to get out with something." And usually liquidates at the very bottom, along with millions of other investors, usually resulting in what we call a final capitulation, a massive 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 day wipeout. Everybody says, "That's it, I'm out." And the people have a tendency to say that all at the same time. Interestingly enough, it is thought that when that happens, that is when the smart money starts buying. The market's experienced or will experience in a capitulation, usually a final brutal sell-off. This selling at the bottom is classic among small retail investors and is the reason why years of gains seem to vanish in market crashes. Ironically, like I said, at the time most investors reach this capitulation point, that is usually the time the smart money starts buying. Establishing a sell point, either by a stock price or percentage of loss, would be a strategy that you might consider. Much like a fire escape, know when it's time to get out before the whole thing goes down in flames. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. And you're tuned to Money Matters on your community radio station. Thanks for joining me today. Market's up 137 today, January 21st. And so the questions are, when will it stop? Well, everybody's got an opinion, like something else we know. And out from Yahoo, Rick Newman. An article today, I'll read from Rick Newman, Yahoo. Finance has this article today. It's a good article, in my opinion. Rick goes on to say, anyone who's ever learned to ski knows the terrifying feeling of pointing your boards downhill, picking up speed, and not being able to stop. I'm going to skip down a few. Most economists agree that the jarring 7% stocks in U.S. securities so far in 2016, actually, it's more like 12%. It's generally getting better, not worse. The economy is, so says Rick Newman. Yet markets don't seem to care. There have been brief pauses in selling, yet traders keep fixating on global problems in China and elsewhere, not on the U.S. economic fundamentals. Weakness in China has generated concern about over-leveraged companies that might fail, punishing investors. Sharp drop in oil price amplifies these worries. And fear of losses usually pushes down the value of risk assets, otherwise known as stocks. Rick goes on to say, the sell-off will end when investors feel prices have fallen by enough to account for whatever bad news might still be lurking undiscovered. The problem is, nobody knows with precision how much asset prices need to correct. Rarely do financial markets find the fair value that's fundamentally justified and then stop, says Jeffrey Rosenberg, quoted in this article. They overshoot. It's really hard to say whether we're at fair value or we're overshot. The process of finding a stock market bottom, they go on to say, gets murkier because overshoots contribute to the pricing action and push the fair value point lower. In that sense, panic selling can be somewhat self-fulfilling. The more selling there is, the greater the impulse to sell. This is what help may explain why falling oil prices, ordinarily a good thing for consumers in the U.S. economy, are now considered a spooky sign of something deeply wrong. Prices should have stabilized as cheaper energy became a windfall for consumers who then spend more and end up pushing up demand. But in the circular logic of panicky markets, lower oil prices now seem to reflect distressed consumers, not wealthier ones. One stabilizing factor of the last 7 years, and also covered in this show many times, missing from the trading action is the Federal Reserve stimulus. Beginning in 07, the Fed undertook monetary stimulus that turned out to be the most aggressive in its 102-year history. But last year marked the peak of its quantitative easing programs. Its attempt to force down interest rates and push investors into riskier assets such as stocks. The program of QE by the Federal Reserve is now slowly unwinding down. And in December, the Feds raised interest rates for the first time in 9 years, signaling a definitive, if not gradual, end to the era of short-term interest rates near zero. That doesn't mean necessarily that the Fed tightening is causing the recent turmoil. But the Fed is not intervening in a way that might stabilize markets as it has in the past. He goes on to say the Fed could reverse course and start stimulating again, a call that was made by Jim Rickards in the Daily Reckoning, I believe. But that would reveal huge worries in the nation's economic brain trust. In other words, what they're saying there is if the Fed reverses and starts QE again, you begin to think they're kind of wishy-washy. My words there. There seems to be more confusion in the markets than usual, given a poor understanding of the Chinese economy, the complicated interplay of various exchange rates, and a sudden lack of interest in the relatively stable U.S. economy. It may be impossible, so says this article by Rick Newman on Yahoo Finance, to put a date on the market bottom. But it will probably arrive when the confusion clears. Well, of course. So, you know, it is stressing to see negative accounts, you know, I realize that. And again, stop losses, exits. You know, don't be ashamed of exits. It's prudent money management, in my opinion, to cut your losses at a certain point. You know, nobody knows. The Martin Weiss website, some of their analysts, which I follow, they're saying that, and also other analysts such as Daily Reckoning, they're saying that once the Fed raised interest rates in the teeth of this thing that was starting to materialize, the markets would reverse hard. And obviously they have reversed hard. So they're saying that if it reverses hard enough, we're going to see more stimulus. Now, just today, Super Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, came out and said that they are going to look at more stimulus, more quantitative easing again. So I've basically said on the show, anytime the markets start to go down, you see the QE come out again and low interest rates come out again. But the Feds, because they just raised them, don't want to look too wishy-washy. So they may stand pat for a while. They may stand pat for a while. You don't know. Or if things get bad enough, they may come out with QE again. Will QE work? I don't know. Has it worked in the last 7 years? You tell me. We can tell that the stock market has gone up, but only 1 in 10 people own stocks. It's a common statistic, about 1 in 10. So the stock market goes well. But we see, you know, nominal wages are questionable, whether we're really earning any more. We're seeing inflation in certain things. You know, I go buy food, I see food go up. The ice cream cans are getting smaller and not so much cereal in cereal boxes. And yet, you know, the government CPI, consumer price index shows, you know, 1%. Feds want to go to 2%. So it is, you know, it is stressful. I understand that. And, you know, if the stress of a falling market is causing you undue stress, then there's always CDs and savings accounts. Of course, the downside to that is if we see inflation again, your CD will sit there while inflation takes off, and you have to participate in the inflation to protect yourself. It's generally thought that the stock market is a good proxy for inflation. It is a good way to protect yourself partially from inflation. But then again, you know, it's the reason they call it a market. There's an old saying, you know, it's really they call it fishing and not catching. Fishing in the market doesn't guarantee you're going to catch anything. So you have to do the best you can to limit losses. And many believe, as I do, that cutting your losses at a certain point, whatever that point is a you know, is a prudent strategy. You know, as prices go down in the stock market, then you can buy more stock with the money you had. So it's like prices of dresses going on sale. You know, when you go to Walmart and prices drop, you can buy more with your money. And then if we do get a rally in the stock market and returns to where it was, you'll realize and participate in that rise that much faster. Problem is, how do you know when it stops? Now, generally, like I said, there are resistant levels that technicians believe represent areas of support and resistance. You know, when it bounces to 15,300, will it find support? You know, when it gets to 16,000, will it find resistance? Will it have trouble getting over that? Previous resistant points on the way down, support levels on the way down, usually act as resistant points on the way up. So, because we blew through 15,000, because we blew through 16,300, that could be regarded as a resistance on the way back up. So you get certain steps on the way back up, minor little rough patches that you have to get through. So now we say, well, is there any inflation with all the quantitative easing? That's a very question that I get all the time. How come we're not seeing inflation, Mark? With all this monetary printing and quantitative easing and low interest rates, we should be seeing inflation. Well, there's a reason that some people believe why we don't see inflation. You know, the Federal Reserve gives money to the banking system. It buys their assets. And when the banking system was under severe stress during the crisis, they had a lot of mortgages that were not marketable. And if they couldn't sell them, or they could sell them, but they'd have to sell them at a fire sale, much like Third Avenue Management, where we covered 2 weeks ago, where they had a lot of bonds in their portfolio, money market portfolio, and they basically stopped investors from withdrawing because they basically said, we cannot fairly value these or will not sell these at fire sales prices. So we won't let you get your money back out. Covered that 2 weeks ago. And so if we look at this and we say, you know, which way is this thing going to go? You have to see the grand picture of where the stock market is and all the things that are feeding into this. Are we seeing inflation? Do you see inflation? What do you think? We're seeing deflation in gas prices, right? You like that. But are you seeing deflation in food prices? And I keep seeing myself, I keep seeing milk go up. You know, half a gallon of organic milk is, $4 now. Crazy eggs and all that. Well, with all the quantitative easing and low interest rates running around for about 7 years now, I do get questioned where all the inflation is. Well, the reason we don't see inflation, one of the reasons we don't see inflation, at least it's thought we don't see inflation, and the Federal Reserve buys these mortgages that the banks could not sell or could not value fairly. And the Federal Reserve came to the banks and they said, give us your mortgages and we will pay you full value for it. The bank said, oh, great. And according to the Federal Reserve's own release that was spurred on by Bloomberg's Freedom of the Press Act, Federal Reserve gave the five largest banks somewhere around $700 billion, $750 billion for their bad mortgages. And originally, Ben Bernanke said they were going to reverse that and give the mortgages back, undo quantitative easing. And they undo it by saying, okay, here are your mortgages back, give us our money back. And then he came out and said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep them. Banks said, great. So then, of course, banks were allowed to post some nice profits, and I'm sure bonuses and salaries may have come along with that. And then the banks go out, and they were supposed to lend it to you and me. Not that I believe that lending money is, borrowing money is good, but certain people believe that is in certain positions. And so they think the bank's going to lend money. But what happened is the banks are required to take some of their money and put it back at the Federal Reserve. So the banks, if they have cash, they're allowed to lend out a lot of it, but some of it's got to be, you got to keep some of it. They say you got to keep some of it in case people want their money. You got to have something in the bank. And they keep that money at the Federal Reserve. It's called excess reserves. Required reserves or excess reserves. Now, up until 2008, when the banks put the money in the Federal Reserve or excess reserves, a certain percentage of what they loaned out, you know, they might have loaned out, you know, $500 billion, and they might be required to keep $5 billion at the Federal Reserve as excess reserves. Don't hold me on that figure, but just that's the theory. Well, if, when money was sitting at the Federal Reserve, it sat there, earning nothing. Well, in 08 and 09, the Federal Reserve said, we are going to pay you interest on the money you give back to us. So the Federal Reserve bought toxic mortgages from the bank. The bank has two choices. I can lend it out to Joe Blow, which might have some risk, or I could put it back at the Federal Reserve where they pay me interest on it. Well, the excess reserves, a lot of these excess reserves have come back to the Federal Reserve and they're paying them interest on it. So because the money is not out in the system, that's why it is believed, one reason why we're not seeing the massive inflation and the Fed doesn't see massive inflation, because the money is still not out in the system. However, who gets quantitative easing? Who benefits from that? If we go to the store and notice some of the things that you buy, things have gone up in price. Have you priced a steak lately? But in general, one could say we're not seeing massive and record inflation in many things. Not like we did in the 80s. Of course, there is one area that we are seeing some eye-popping inflation, yet I doubt any of you play in this arena, nor even know what's happening in there. We're talking about the super rich and the toys they buy. And in that playground, we are seeing some eye-popping inflation in many recent sales of collectibles. And I'm not talking a collectible Beanie Baby. I'm talking big money. The world record for a diamond sale was broken 2 months ago. Sotheby's reports an eye-popping $48.4 million was paid for a 12.03-carat deep blue stone. The previous record was $28 million, set the night before. December saw a record price in a ruby bought at Christie's in Hong Kong, $18 million for a 15-carat stone. October saw a sapphire stone, new high, $6.7 million in Hong Kong. Coins of the very rare variety are also fetching astronomical valuations as a 1894-Ace-S Barber Dime brought its previous owner $1.9 million. No records were set for stamps or Roman coins last year, but both classes are rising very high valuations. So says Financial Sense. Ditto for classic cars, so says the website. The second most expensive painting sold last year when Christie's offered a Modigliani for $170 million. So with all the rare things skyrocketing, somebody's doing well. And there's no doubt that those that are at these auctions don't live in the neighborhood that you and I do. So the question I first posed here is, where is all the quantitative easing money going? And with all these new records on rare things and rare whatnots by the one percenters, could you deduce exactly where the money is going? Question mark. As for me, I am breaking new records at my house. I paid more for my health care in 2015 than I ever had before. And I can't remember a time when I paid $16 for a piece of tri-tip steak, which I could eat all by myself, just like I did last weekend. How about you? Are you buying any rare art lately? Or are you more like me and rarely having any spare dollars? You are tuned to your economic forum, Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Thank you for listening to your community radio station. We'll be right back. And you're tuned to Money Matters on your community radio station. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Thank you for listening today. So in that same vein, Wall Street, out from Yahoo Finance again. Anybody see the last debate, Democratic debate? Yahoo Finance says Hillary Clinton continues to struggle on the left with criticism that she is too close to Wall Street and would not do enough to rein in the nation's largest banks. Now she's pulling out a new defense, saying she is just like President Barack Obama, who took a lot of money in 2008. It's a risky strategy that liberal Democrats so far aren't buying. The new defense, I didn't see the debate myself, so this is from the article. The new defense was on display in Sunday night's Democratic debate when Bernie Sanders ripped Clinton for taking money for a campaign from big banks and getting personal speaking fees from Goldman Sachs. What do you think about that? The vampire squid. A name given by one of the, I think it was Daily Reckoning or one of those gives it. Vampire squid. We had a show 2 weeks ago called The Zombie Apocalypse. Did you like that one? I got a lot of emails on that one. Clinton fired back, saying there's no daylight between her and Sanders on regulating Wall Street, saying there should be no bank too big to fail and no individual too powerful to jail. Huh. Did we see any big banks fail last time? Did we see any big bankers jailed? Then she pulled out the Obama card. But where we disagree is the comments that Senator Sanders has made that just doesn't affect me. I can take that, but he's criticized President Obama for taking donations from Wall Street, and President Obama has led our country out of the Great Recession. I'm going to defend President Obama for taking on Wall Street, taking on the financial industry, and getting results. Hmm. Well, we already know the big banks are bigger than where they were in 2008, and the derivative market is bigger, up in the hundreds of trillions. Derivatives are bets by banks. Wow. It's incredible. You know, I've been watching. My son has a Wii. And they've been doing a lot of homework lately, so I got a chance to check out the Wii and all the things it's been showing. And one of the things that I've gravitated to is World War II footage. And I already knew this, but there was a lot of coverage in these Nazi files and the rest about how Hitler came to power. And one of the positions in these videos, of which I agree with, is that when things get bad enough, people want somebody strong to fix things. And after World War I, Germany was gutted by its enemies, and they had to pay war reparations. And they had to dismantle their army and their navy. And it was just, you know, they really put a lot of pressure on Hitler. I mean, on the German economy. And so up rose Hitler, who said he would fix things. And the German economy got to be a mess. I mean, it was just a real, real mess. And so Hitler rose saying he was going to fix things and brings back Germany to greatness. So when things get bad enough, really bad, people don't want the same old, same old. They want somebody to come in with power and promise, you know, that we're going to fix things. So, you know, it's in my opinion, is this perhaps why we're seeing some more obscure candidates come to the forefront saying, you know, we need an iron fist? So when things get bad enough, people, you know, start voting for radical solutions because they just want somebody to fix it. Now, it is interesting that we're seeing, you know, I know the stock market has gone up from 2008-2009. It's up 137 right now. But, you know, we've had five or six rounds of quantitative easing, 6 or 7 years of this, and now Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank, is coming out and saying he's going to do it again. And so, you know, I wonder, do you keep trying something that may not be working? I mean, it's working in the inflation in rare collectibles in art, obviously. But is that you and I? You know, is that the stuff that you and I buy? No, I don't buy collectible art. Can't afford it. Can you? And so, you know, we look at this stuff and we say, is it working? Is it not working? Who's it working for? Is it working for me? Is it working for you? And so I've got another article here. And this is also penned by myself. With the markets now again in turmoil and Washington acknowledging the recovery is starting to look like a no-show, investors are left wondering if we are in for another meltdown or just a temporary soft patch. Soft patch. They've used that word a few times. Problems stemming from the ongoing European debt crisis and rumors of a continuing banking concerns worldwide combined with our own slowing economy has put a damper on investor enthusiasm. Obviously. Dow up 149 now. The latest consumer confidence numbers are less than ideal, and a falling Dow Jones Industrial Average attests to new stresses in financial markets. 7 years after the economies of the world nearly imploded, and with trillions of bailout money now gone, the crisis that many thought was behind us may once again be rearing its ugly head. The reason we are seeing new volatility in both the banking sector and the markets is because the underlying problem was most likely misunderstood by monetary authorities around the globe. You need no look no farther for proof than in a statement by Le Quoin. I hope I pronounced that right. Governor of Belgium's central bank, who told French-language daily newspaper La Libre Blique, the chief problem in Europe is that of liquidity. Many analysts think this is not a liquidity problem, but a solvency problem, however. What's the difference? Liquidity can be described as you asking me for 10 bucks that I owe you. I owe you $10. And I tell you, I have the 10 bucks, but I don't have it on me. That is a liquidity problem. I have the money, but it's not available to me at this instant. In this case, a loan to me for $10 to pay you will solve the problem. I can pay the loan back to whoever gave me the 10 to give to you with the $10 that I have. A solvency problem is different. A solvency problem is where I owe you the 10 bucks, and not only do I not have the $10 on me, I don't have it anywhere. I don't have a liquidity problem because now I am not solvent. Trillions of dollars in home loans is essentially IOUs, right? Mortgages on IOU were sliced, diced, and packaged up into complicated asset offerings and sold worldwide. Eventually, debt markets everywhere were saturated with this stuff. When the housing market imploded, many of these IOUs became worthless. Instead of liquidating these loans and allow those holding the debt to swallow the losses, because they made profits on them, central banks made more loans to backstop the original ones, essentially borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, you being Peter. The debt never really went away. Those mortgages are now held at the Federal Reserve. So those mortgages weren't paid off. They were bought and held at the Federal Reserve. The amount of liquidity in the system was never the issue. It was the actual solvency of these loans. By allowing all those loans to survive, so to speak, now housed the Federal Reserve, financial institutions, central banks, and entire countries holding this stuff are still insolvent, according to some, and no amount of money conjured up to fill their operating balance sheets will make that disappear. The fact remains all those homeowners back then stopped paying. And tossing money at the system every month may solve a temporary cash flow problem, but much like a housewife gone crazy with a credit card, you can pay off this month's bills, but not next month. Then you have the same problem again. Couple that with higher government deficits, the amount of debt and promises that now exist in markets everywhere are soaking up any and all monies tossed at them. Like the proverbial hungry alligator, whose appetite can never be satiated. Unless we kill off the debt beast altogether, it will continue to reappear in many forms. But since the food the alligator eats is just more acquired debt, the alligator just gets bigger with every feeding because of the interest on that debt. Remember, when you don't pay it off, the interest grows and grows and grows and grows. This is why the amounts we hear to bail out Greece or Spain or Portugal or Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, the FHA, and who knows who else is getting larger with each news headline. Recognize the problem. Recognizing the problem goes back to the basic logic. You can't solve a debt problem by amassing more debt. Each time you cover each feeding with another round of bailouts, loans, stimulus, or whatever you call it, it's just making more debt to pay off previous debt. And deficit figures from Washington and other central banks seem to confirm this. The solution lies in repudiating the debt, either through default or selling it at a discount. Because the debt is held by the world's most powerful institutions and even central banks, the death of these massive debts will most likely cause tremendous upheaval and financial convulsions in the markets worldwide. And this is what the central bankers of the world are desperately trying to avoid. The first step in solving a problem is recognizing the problem. Can you solve a debt problem by amassing more debt? Now, how difficult is that? You're listening to Money Matters on a community radio station. We'll wrap up the show in just a second. We're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money. The skies are sunny. Old Man Depression, you are through. You've done us wrong. We never see a headline, but a red line today. And when we see the landlord, we can look. tuned to Money Matters on your community radio station. We've run out of time. Thanks for joining me today. My name's Mark Cuniberti. You've been listening to show number 225, Markets Rock and Roll. Remember that discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investor advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Once again, thanks for joining me. Have a great day and a good week. This has been another edition of Money Matters. Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and are opinions only, and may not represent those of this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. This show is not meant as investment advice. Consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions, and do your own research before investing. The information given on the show was obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing, but is not guaranteed. This show was pre-recorded at an earlier date, so the market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at the time of airing. Money Matters is produced and recorded at the studios of KVMR FM 89.5 in Nevada City, California. You can visit our website at moneymanagementradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.